This is a rebroadcast of Migrant Matters. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Interested in the social political life of publication? Care about dissemination of marginalized voices? Care about creating works that advocate for political agency for radical change? I audio captured a June 12th, 2013 presentation by independent grassroots artists Leila Portavov, Agata Mrozowsk, and Mary Tremonte. Leila Portavov and Agata Mrozowsk are artists in residency at the Ontario College of Art and Design University's Public Action Thematic Residency. They talk about the art project they're currently working on, which focuses on recent immigration policies in Canada and migrant justice organizing. Mary Tremonte is co-facilitator of the Public Action Thematic Residency with Shannon Girard and presents the Just Seeds Migration Now portfolio. With members working from the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, Just Seeds Artist Cooperative is a decentralized network of 24 artists committed to making print and design work that reflects a radical social, environmental, and political stance. This is The Talk.
So I'm Leila. We're going to just tonight kind of go over the project that we're working on, but as way of an introduction, so we're friends. We've been friends for a few years, and what we decided to do for the residency was focus on recent immigration policies and specific cases in Canada, sort of mostly over the course of the period that the Harper government's been in power, but some of the stuff stretches a bit back, and of course, some of it goes way back. And part of the reason we decided to work on this was because we both have organizing experience. I did more migrant justice stuff, which I haven't been doing so much the past few years because I've been in grad school, and Agata has more of a history of working on Indigenous rights issues. And these are the two issues that we're kind of trying to bring together in the project that we're working on, mostly focused, again, as I said, on recent stuff. And then I guess the other thing to note is that we're both first-generation immigrants ourselves, and that was also a conversation that kind of we had when we were talking about this stuff, because actually the policies that our family used to come here, I came here during the Iran-Iraq War, and it was part of family reunification is what we used to come here, and the shifts in that policy would make it so that my family couldn't have come currently.
Yeah, same for my family. Like, we came here in the early 80s during communist times in Poland when there was a lot of, like, state repression and a lot of, like, really unstable economic times there. A lot of difficulty, like, accessing food and that kind of stuff. And so we were sponsored by family here and wouldn't definitely have not been able to have immigrated under the current reforms to immigration.
Yeah. And of course, those histories informed the organizing work we did, but also I think as immigrants, having a relationship to Indigenous struggles in Canada, on Turtle Island, is a specific thing. It's something that you kind of end up learning a lot later, I would say, because it's not something you learn in school and you don't even know Canadian history, and then you learn the bullshit version of Canadian history, and then eventually you learn the real version of it. So we're going to kind of navigate some of that stuff too in the eventual project, which is going to be a little publication, which is completely not done. So what we're going to show you today are some visuals from it that we're working on, and then talk about the specific references that these visuals are making. But we thought we'd show a few older things that we've worked on. So this is a graphic from Solidarity Cross Borders, which is a Montreal migrant justice organization. And I was involved in the group, but also on the art committee for several years. And what we did was what you usually do in these groups. We made posters, we made banners, we made both. So these are a series of banners that we did for an annual migrant justice march. This is from 2006, and we also made posters of them. I was also involved in No One's Illegal, another migrant justice organization. Again, a banner that was also made into a poster.
And so this, I had done a portrait of Harriet Nahni, who was like an elder in BC around the, there was a lot of infrastructure being built in 2010 around the Olympics, and she was protesting and was protecting like native land from destruction, which a lot of it was destroyed, and so she was jailed and got sick in jail. When she was released, she ended up dying from pneumonia. And so at the same time, there was, there's always land struggles happening all across Turtle Island, but there was a fight happening in Tandanega, where a friend of ours, Sean Brandt, was at the time arrested, and so we threw like a fundraiser to raise money for the legal costs, and that was from this. And then this is also from that same fundraiser, and it says Canada's Colonial Unity Coast to Coast, which basically just shows all the rail lines across like the Canadian landmass, and a lot of the direct action tactics that were used around the Six Nations land reclamation and in Tandanega were blocking the rail lines, economic disruption, and then this was like a more recent one that me and a bunch of friends did for the Idle No More. It was for the missing, the 500, over 500 missing murdered women, and every February 14th there's a vigil that happens in front of the police station at the headquarters, police headquarters. And so this is our centerfold for our publication, and it's the Nishiu Youth Movement, so the Nishiu Walkers, which were a group of Cree youth that walked 1,700 kilometers to Ottawa
in the winter.
In the winter. So this is, and then the borders are traditional like Polish folk pattern in the middle and then Iranian folk patterns on the sides, and so we're kind of just like incorporate, well, I mean, yeah. I think that's the next slide.
Also, this is part of Idle No More, so they marched in support of Teresa Spence's hunger strike, so this is recent. I think the march...
Yeah, and like all the bill, like there was like bills passed, Bill C-45, I think it was, which just eroded a lot of Indigenous rights in the changes that had passed in December, and so I think the Idle No More movement kind of started in response to kind of saying this is bullshit to those reforms.
So one of the conversations we had when we started working on this project was about what kinds of visuals to use and how. We talked about this with Mary a lot, and Mary's going to be talking about the Immigration Now portfolio of Just Seeds, which is a collective she's involved in. But if you also look back, if we go back to the original slides, a lot of migrant justice visuals often use things like birds, butterflies, fences, walls. So we wanted to do something different, and what we decided to do was, as sort of a visual unifier for the publication, we're going to use images that are incorporating Persian rug motifs with Polish kind of
folk embroidery patterns,
and the idea that these are domestic sort of visuals that you see in domestic space, and it's kind of, migration is about finding a home and making a home. And so, and it also kind of ties our own stories to the project. So you're not going to see a lot of examples of it, but that was one example. Another one we're working on is this one. So this is Farshad Mohammadi. He was a government-sponsored conventional refugee from Kham Iran. So that's in the north of Iran. He was Kurdish. He was a Kurdish rebel who was persecuted and came to Canada seeking asylum, and was held in detention for 7 months and then was given permanent residency in 2006. So he was accepted as a refugee, given permanent residence in 2006, but he actually suffered from several different kinds of mental health problems and became homeless while he was in Canada. One of the things that he suffered from was post-traumatic stress disorder, because he lived for a period in the mountains of Iran and was persecuted severely. He had mental health problems, was in Montreal, was a Montreal resident, was struggling on and off with homelessness, and he ended up being killed by police in early 2012. But before that happened, the story actually brings together new immigration policies, because in 2009, he was charged with and convicted of breaking an entry into a non-residential building. He'd broken into a building to sleep overnight, and he was charged with it. He got 1 day of prison and 2 years of probation for that, which he served. But under the new immigration policies, there's a new thing under the Immigration and Refugee Act called double punishment that happens, which is that even if you have permanent residency, if you're convicted of a serious crime, you can still be deportable and sort of be put back into a different category before permanent residence kind of were dealt with legally more like Canadian citizens. So because he was convicted of breaking an entry, the immigration officer that worked with him deemed it a serious crime, and he actually got a deportation order. So he had an assessment done, and they deemed him inadmissible. So he got a detention order, which actually made his mental health problems far worse. He was living in complete fear. And what ended up happening was a few months after this happened, and according to his lawyer, he was in a state of extreme panic at all times. He was in the metro station at Montreal, again, seeking refuge. It was in the winter. So he was hanging out in the metro station in Montreal, cold Montreal winter. Police approached him. There was an altercation where he pulled out an X-Acto knife, and then he was shot several times. Eyewitnesses say that he was actually walking away at the time that he was shot, and most recently, actually just a few weeks ago, the metro station sort of security admitted that they doctored the video that they released to the public, which doesn't show the actual shooting. And there is a version of the video now that is supposed to get released that does show the shooting. So we'll see what that happens. But okay, so he's one of the people we'll be featuring in our publication.
So this is another image that we did for the publication. If you read the buttons, it says snitch line, and it's being cut because in 2011, the immigration minister, Jason Kenney, and another conservative member of parliament, it's his name, Vic Toews, created phone lines across the country, and they're dedicated to reporting and deporting people. So people are encouraged to call in on these snitch lines and snitch on people that they suspect of being, you know, here illegally or committing immigration fraud. And so these phone lines are one amongst many tactics the government has used to create fear and mistrust with immigrant communities who are facing unprecedented levels of precarity.
It's a depressing talk.
It's a very depressing talk.
We should have given you guys a warning.
Yeah.
Okay. So this looks all happy. It's this is our visual that we're going to work with. But these are not real people, so we don't have a tragic story about them specifically. But so this is the visual we're working with for the family reunification changes that have happened. So in 2001, Jason Kenney, who is our increasingly atrocious immigration minister, imposed a two-year freeze on applications of parents and grandparents in the family reunification program. And so that affected 165,000 people who were at the time applying for this program. And the point of the freeze, according to the conservative government, was to do a rehaul of the family reunification program. So they did the rehaul, and earlier this year, they released the new plan. So under the new plan, there are several shifts. So the first one is that they've imposed 5,000 maximum. So they are only going to allow 5,000 spots per year for family reunification. Previously, there was no sort of maximum. And it's based on a first-come, first-served basis. So if you have a really good case, but you're 5,023 person, or the 5,023rd person who applied, it's too bad for you. They also increased the income of the people who are in sponsoring by 30%. So now you have to earn at least $55,000 to be able to be a sponsor. And the time that you're responsible for the person you're sponsoring doubled from 10 years to 20 years. So essentially for a good part of your life. So it's a good incentive for people to not sponsor family members. Another thing that they did was they changed it so that children, or your children who are over 18, are no longer eligible. So previously, if you had a kid who was over 18, but they were still dependent on you or still a student, let's say they're second year university students, college students, something like this, they would be eligible under family reunification, but current policy says that they're not. And then lastly, there is this exciting alternative that they presented for all the people who can't get in under the new system, or if they miss the 5,000 point, which is called the super visa. And the super visa is basically a way for people who have money to get around some of these things, because it's really targeting people who are coming from a fairly wealthy demographic. So it's a visa that's granted for up to 10 years to family members, parents, grandparents, children, and you can stay in Canada for up to 2 years within the 10 years, and then you have to leave and come back. And in the time that you're here, you have to have private insurance. You don't get any Canadian benefits. You don't have any access to permanent residency. And if you get the super visa, you don't ever get permanent residency. So this is their new awesome plan that they've introduced.
Sounds super.
We're going to just do two more.
And so I'm going to read this if it's okay, but this is Juana Tejada. She was a Filipino woman who came to Canada in 2003 through the Live-In Caregivers program. After working as a domestic worker for a few years, she was eligible to apply for permanent residency. At the time, under the program regulations, individuals, foreign domestic workers, mostly from the Philippines and the Caribbean, could be granted permanent resident status after they complete three-year assignments if they obtained medical and criminal record clearances. But Juana was diagnosed with colon cancer in 2006 and was made to face removal and was initially denied the appropriate health care because she was deemed a health burden. Migrant women like Juana who work in Canada as caregivers face exploitative conditions. For 3 years, Juana worked from 6:30 a.m. to bedtime, taking care of children and other household duties. When she could no longer fulfill these duties because of severe illness, the Canadian government deemed her expendable and tried to send her back. Juana was a fighter and a leader in her community against the unjust policies. She fought her own case, won an appeal, and got status. She also was an outspoken advocate for other women who faced similar situations and organized for the next few years to change the unjust laws that apply to living caregivers, such as the two-step medical examination process. Under the program, a caregiver has to pass a medical test to come to Canada, and then, when applying for immigration, has to pass another medical test. So Juana died of cancer Sunday, March 8, 2009, at Toronto General Hospital. She was 39. A year later, in April 2010, the Government of Canada, due to the pressure from organizers and community members such as Juana, changed the mandatory requirement for all live-in caregivers, and they are now no longer required to complete the second medical examination during their application process for permanent residency. So they still have to undergo a ridiculous amount of bureaucracy and jump really insulting hoops. And so this is
a portrait of Juana.
The significant thing about them removing the second exam, and this is something that happened as a result of community organizing and people like Juana, but is that if you get a disease or an illness while you're in Canada, then that's not going to affect your ability to become a permanent resident, which previously it did. So obviously she was diagnosed while she was here. People have worksite accidents while they're here, and so this is supposed to help. So this is going to be the last one we do. These are three individuals who are currently still under some format of security certificates in Canada. How many of you have heard of security certificates? Or maybe how many of you haven't heard of security certificates? So security certificate is an immigration policy that's been around for a long time, but it was, again, sort of reintroduced in 2002. So it's post-9/11 that it really took off as a thing in Canada. And again, it's under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. And it allows the Government of Canada to detain non-citizens. So these are people who may have permanent residency, as many of the people who are currently held on security certificates do, but are not yet citizens. So that it's allowed to detain them without charges or trial for years on the basis of secret or suspicious allegations and evidence. So basically, the government arrests and has done this to five individuals, five Muslim men, in fact, under suspicions of terrorism, arrests them, puts them in detention center, has given them really draconian, insane. I'll give you some of the examples of the kinds of conditions that they've had to live with. And some of them have been living with these conditions for over a decade now. The thing started in 2002, without ever telling them what they're charged with or what the evidence against them is. And without ever setting sort of proper mechanisms where they could fight a cause against them, and held them indefinitely in detention. So when they were being held in detention, they didn't even know how long this process was going to go on for. So as I said, since 2002, there's been five people who've been held on it, and four of them were sent to actually a facility in Kingston. So probably a lot of you know about this facility, but for those of you who don't know, many of the people that are organizing around this issue call it Guantanamo North, because it's very much like Guantanamo. So it's a facility for people that are being held without charges that are non-citizens, permanent residents. So all five people were actually granted refugee status in Canada and were on their way to citizenship when this happened. And the other one, the fifth one, has been living under house arrest. But house arrest includes conditions like they're never allowed to be alone ever. So they always, 24 hours a day, have to be accompanied by their wife or whoever's allocated to them. So it's usually a family member. which obviously affects the life of that family member a great deal. If they want to leave the house for, I believe it's for Harkat, who is the person in the middle, his condition for leaving the house is that he has to give 48-hour notice to the authorities. He has to be accompanied by two authorities for up to 4 hours, two times a week. He's allowed to leave the house. Those are his house arrest conditions. They're not allowed to use cell phones or any digital equipment, so no internet, no cell phones, no computers. What's interesting about those rules is one of them, who's not featured here, because the charges against him actually have been dropped now. It's a man named Adil Shirkawi, and he was completing a graduate degree. He was completing a master's degree at the time, and he did complete his master's degree without access to internet, a computer, or cell phones. So quite the feat. Anyway, there's all sorts of crazy rules that have applied to them under the house arrest condition, not to mention that several of them, including two out of these three, were held in detention, in solitary confinement for over a year, one of them. So just to name them, Mohammed Mahjoub is the person on the left. He's currently won a lot of his case, but it hasn't been completely dropped against him. Harkat is the middle one. He's still fighting against his security certificate and Mahjoub.
Yeah.
Who is also still fighting his case. The other thing to note is that the Canadian government actually itself in 2007 deemed security certificates unconstitutional based on the fact that it was based on secret evidence and no trial and all of these things that we mentioned. But the year after, the Harper government reintroduced almost exactly the same law with one sort of shift in it, which is the introduction of special advocates. So rather than letting their lawyers or themselves know what the charges are, the immigration minister, again, this would be Jason Kenney, allocates a lawyer of his choice who gets to look at the evidence and then speak on behalf of the evidence to the court, but they still don't know what the charges or evidence against them are. And last December, CSIS admitted that they did obtain the evidence that would be used to prosecute them under torture. So all of the evidence that they have is also evidence that they got under torture. And then just on a last depressing note, I was going to read a quote from Jabala's son, but one of the things that they did to Ahmed Jabala, one of the reasons he was sort of handed a certificate, if you are to listen to his narrative about it and believe him, is that CSIS had been visiting him for a period of time prior to him being issued a security certificate, and they'd actually approached him to be an informant because he was kind of a well-known figure in the mosque that he was at, and the mosque that he was a member of was deemed radical by the Canadian government. So they'd asked him to be an informant, and he had refused. And so his son, who was someone I was on a panel with once, and when he was talking about it, he was saying that at the time he was 12 years old and his dad didn't really speak English well. So when they would get CSIS visits, it would be his son that would have to translate, because CSIS wouldn't show up with people who spoke Arabic, who'd have to translate from English to Arabic to his father threats from CSIS of what would happen to him if he was to not cooperate with CSIS. And so this happened prior to him even getting the security certificates. So obviously, examples of racial profiling, really racist immigration policy, really racist criminalization, so on and so forth. That's the fun stuff that our project is looking at. So we're just showing you kind of some of the sketches that we're working on. These visuals are going to get filled in with a bunch of other stuff. And we have a bunch of other policies. I think we, in total, are going to do something like 14 of these. So we showed you 6 out of the 14 that we're doing.
Are you having a text component?
Yeah, for sure. That's the reason. We kind of were debating whether we should do them as posters or a booklet or a publication. And the reason we went with publication was because the text is, some of them, especially like these, it's going to be fairly text heavy and it wouldn't work as a poster, and we really want people to actually understand what these cases are about, and less propaganda and more actually giving some information. So we thought publication would be a better format to do that.
Yeah. Is this information readily available?
Yeah. All of these guys have individual support websites, so there's activist groups that have been working with them throughout this whole period. And so there's that, and then there was actually a People's Commission, so an event that was held in Montreal in 2007, I think, that brought together lawyers, academics, sort of historians, activists who've been working on security certificates, and that created a group called the People's Commission. They have a website that has all the information about all these cases.
So everybody who's been issued one of these security certificates, we could look them up?
Yeah, very easily.
Is there a disproportionate number of people from specific ethnic groups on that list?
There's only 5 Muslim men on that list. So these are 3 of them. The other 2, the charges against them have now been dropped, and they're actually, both of them are currently suing the Canadian government for years of a messed up life. Yeah. And the person on the left, I think that's going to happen hopefully soon also. He's been having a lot of victories in recent months. Mm-hmm. So that will leave too. But yeah, all the information about all 5 of them is on the website. So yeah, we're going to include also resources in our...
It'd be interesting to look it up.
Yeah, totally. So we're going to just pass it off to Mary, but we were going to also invite this other group to come today, but they weren't able to make it because we wanted the theme more broadly to be migrant justice and sort of visual arts and how art can be used to support migrant justice struggle. And I'm just going to plug their project because they can't be here. So there's a group called Kwentong Bayan, which means labor of love. And it's a group, it's a collective actually. It's 3 women who are working with living caregivers to develop a comic book, a full book that kind of narrates different stories of living caregivers. This is a postcard they made with them for Mother's Day. I can pass it around or you guys can come look at it. It's pretty cute. But they're going to be working on that project over the next year. So that's exciting. And then Mary's going to talk to you guys about the Just Seats portfolio.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna abbreviate this presentation a little bit because it has kind of more of an overview of Just Seats and some of the many projects we've done, but I'm just going to kind of flip ahead to our most recent portfolio project on migrant justice. But just real quick, Just Seeds Artist Cooperative, we're a decentralized group of artists making design and print work on issues of social and environmental justice and in conjunction with social movements. And we're based all over, mostly the U.S. There's 2 of us in Canada, 3 of us based in Mexico, but most of us are based in the U.S. There's 24 of us. Yeah, and so this is most of us at one of our annual planning retreats. We have a website where we have an online store where we distribute our work, and also a really active blog. This is an old slide from about 2 years ago. But yeah, it's updated almost every day on topics intersecting with art and social movement, street art, social justice, print work, and projects that our members are doing. So we've done 4 group portfolio projects, which includes the work of most of the people in our group, as well as other artists. And the point of these portfolios is to make new propaganda, make new graphics for people to use in movement work instead of the same kind of clip art that gets used, that tends to get used over and over again, and also work directly with groups working for social change. Our first project we did was for the Critical Resistance 10-year anniversary conference on prisons and alternatives to prisons. So we make these fine art print portfolios, and so you have this art object. We donate about 1/2 of them to groups that are working on the topics, and they can use them however they want. Often people hold on to them and then use them as a way to have an event, have an art show, have like visual component to discuss issues that they're working on. They also, so I'll just flip through this real quick while I'm talking about them all together. And all of our portfolios have an online component, and all of the images are available for free downloads. Then people end up adapting them and using them as necessary in kind of materials on the ground, in pamphlets, posters, that sort of thing. We also did one on resource extraction. And for that portfolio, really individual members were working directly with groups working on these issues. And then we did one about 2 years ago with Iraq Veterans Against the War on generally on post-traumatic stress disorder, and also preventing the redeployment of troops with post-traumatic stress disorder, and also about sexual assault in the military. So this started as a wheat-paste project that happened on Veterans Day in the States, which is in early November. So we had our annual planning retreat then, and it was fall 2010. And so we were all in town, and we all got a bunch of information from IVAW on the topics that they wanted covered for this campaign. And then our individual members designed and printed material, brought it with us in person to Chicago. And then we met out in groups with a bunch of the vets, and we pasted it all over Chicago and documented it for the media. And then we made it also into a fine art portfolio in the format of the other portfolios. And again, everything's like available for download on the website. I'm gonna skip ahead a little bit, just showing some of the graphic work we've done.
a lot of our members were really involved with Occupy in Brooklyn and then OccuPrint, which was a way to document and then put out into print a lot of the graphics that were generated during the Occupy movement. Yeah, so skipping ahead, we've been working, so for our most recent portfolio, it was actually in the works for several years, and it was spearheaded by Fabiana Rodriguez, who is really active on her own in migrant justice stuff in the States, looking at the laws in the States, especially with the U.S.-Mexico border and Latino and Chicano immigrants. And so this was a project we did with the graphics that we were planning to print in the portfolio. This is for the Pittsburgh Biennial. So it's an installation in a gallery of translating two-dimensional images into a three-dimensional space. So we built a bunch of billboards, kind of sculptural billboards, and then we oftentimes projected and traced or cut out, wheat-pasted with cut paper, our graphics that we intended to have in the portfolio into this installation. And this was a facet of the Pittsburgh Biennial that was focusing on artist collectives, so we were alongside some other groups that are working collectively, often politically. We also, that same year, we were in the Graphics Biennial in Ljubljana, it's the International Graphics Biennial, and so we did an installation, like a solo exhibition for that ended up being a print installation. And so in discussing for that ahead of time, again, we were like, okay, we're working on this migration portfolio, let's look at that theme in Ljubljana. Because it was an international context, none of us speak Slovenian. We wanted to work without any words at all in our images. Also, just like in general, we're trying to just look at different ways to aesthetically represent political issues and just kind of continually generate new visual languages for talking about politics. I don't know if we're always successful, but a lot of us are often trying to just like try things out in a new way, and you know, because different people respond differently to different kinds of aesthetics and language. So this is another experiment with that. So we made, we all again individually in our own cities, same as the IVAW project, we designed and printed images of migratory people and animals, endangered species, and then brought them all to Ljubljana and we pasted them in this space. And so made this kind of wordless installation about migration and about the movement of human and non-human species and the hindrance of that movement. We put in some hindrances like dams, images of capitalism, prisons, detention centers, etc. And then also the free movement of capital. So we made this this big sculpture of a shipping container for that. So those are some other approaches that we had to the topic of migration, in kind of more of an art, like a fine art, institutional art context. And then we finally were able to finish our portfolio. So the idea with this portfolio, it was co-sponsored by Just Seeds and Culture Strike, which is a cultural workers working on migrant issues organization that Fabiana is part of, was again to generate new graphics and images for Asia's migration in the States. And also, we wanted to make a wheat paste component, so like a mass-produced printed component, which we haven't done yet because the funding ran out for the project. We were able to complete the portfolio, and we showed it in Toronto in February alongside other groups that are doing graphics on issues of migration in Canada, like Radical Design School and No One Is Illegal, and also a little bit from the Beehive Collective. So we showed that here, and I'll show you a few of the images from that portfolio. Our process with this, and I don't have the wealth of like information that you guys presented tonight on specific cases, but a lot of the people in our group were working locally or at least nationally with specific groups that are working on migration issues. So again, a variety of approaches, aesthetic approaches, and just different angles of the issue. I think one of the strengths of doing a portfolio project and then being able to like show it all together is really both being able to show personal stories, but then also showing a variety of angles on an issue. And so these were all, we designed them, and then we sent them in to Fabiana, and she worked with some professional printers in a print shop in the Bay Area, and they printed all of them. So we actually didn't touch any of the actual like objects that were created at the end. We just designed them. This is most of our members were looking at immigration in the States. And looking at the way that policies affect families. Again, for a lot of people, like, the way that this has affected them personally is if they know someone who was affected personally by immigration policy, or if they themselves have been affected. So just showing a variety of these issues. UndocuQueer is kind of a growing movement in the States, and I don't know if there's like a connection in Canada as well. But like using the language of like coming out as gay or queer, and then also coming out as undocumented, and doing that really publicly, and using that as a tactic to draw attention to, you know, the injustice around being undocumented and facing deportation, particularly the way families can be torn apart because gay marriage is illegal in the U.S., so those unions aren't recognized. This is one graphic from Jesse Purcell, who is our Canadian member. I live here, but I'm not Canadian. He also did this as a billboard for the Pittsburgh Biennial, and this was also on like a lot of the graphic material and promotion for the Pittsburgh Biennial. So this image got a lot of mileage within Pittsburgh. So yeah, that's where I'm going to stop with that. Just showing another collection of images, art images around migration and immigration.
Thanks, Mary.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a June 12th, 2013 presentation by independent grassroots artists Leila Portavov, Agata Mrozowsk, and Mary Tremonte. They'll talk about art projects they're currently working on, which focus on state immigration policies and migrant justice organizing. You can find more audio recordings of talks and interviews focusing on migrant justice issues by going online to radioforall.net. That's radio with the number 4, all.net. And on that site, use the search terms Migrant Matters Radio. We're based in Guelph and featured on a few community radio shows in the Guelph area. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.